Hi, welcome to Pocket Docs, short documentaries, monologues and musings. I'm Natalie Kestacher. Some friends can talk about anything. There are no taboos. Rosa and Ryan have that kind of friendship. They've studied, travelled, lived together and can talk loudly at length about anything. But 5 years after they first met, one of them realised that there was still one discussion they hadn't yet had, and it wasn't going to be easy. Please note there's some distressing content and language in this piece.
We need to talk. I hate those words. They make my stomach drop. Those moments in your life you completely dread. A person to confront, a phone call to make, a discussion to have.
Yummy. Okay, I'm so nervous right now. I can't even use my hands. Okay.
When you start becoming friends with someone, you start slow. First, you learn their likes and their dislikes, their quirks and intricacies. And then there comes a time in many friendships where you start to learn about each other's most intimate and personal stories. Ryan is one of my closest friends. We've studied together, travelled together, lived together. There was nothing we couldn't talk about, no topic too taboo. Except one story. And as we became closer and closer, it became obvious to me that we needed to have this discussion. But where to start? Right at the beginning, I guess.
Ryan, how long have we known each other?
I'm going to say probably about 5 years now, since 2011. Since 2012, sorry, 2012.
About 4 years.
I think the first memory, you're not going to like this, would probably be of you in language and discourse class way back at uni. And I think because you'd already done uni before and you'd had a few years of having to deal with annoying kids in their first year, you knew everything. And so my first memory of you was basically going, no, that I'm pretty sure, and I can't remember what you said, but it would have been some ridiculous opinion of some sort.
I hated being in that class. I hated all of you. I hated all of you. I was in my 20s.
I remember Ryan vaguely in that class. I wasn't that interested in becoming friends with him, but, you know, sometimes you end up being drawn to people whether you like it or not. I forget the topic we were discussing, but I do remember Ryan talking about the private boarding school he went to, and immediately I was internally rolling my eyes. And then he said how he was at that boarding school thanks to his trust fund. Again, I'm thinking, ugh, trust fund. And then he mentioned it was his mother's trust fund. Why would he have a trust fund from his mother? Where's his mother? And then I realised.
Oh, crap. I'm that person that judges a book by its cover and I don't know the full story. And the thing is, since then I've never actually spoken to you about it or asked you about it, but I just know that she's not here. And I've always known that and I've always been too scared to talk about it, to ask you about it. And so...
And I never buy flowers. It's strange because this year we normally get them from our garden. Our garden's amazing. We're on a corner block and Nan does beautiful things with the garden, but this year there just wasn't many in bloom. So I had to go and buy some.
When was the first... Do you have a memory of the first moment that you knew? That you just knew that someone had taken away your mother from you?
Well, because it happened so young, I was told, you know, she died in a car crash kind of thing.
Really?
Just because it's a lot more normal.
Yeah.
And you kind of see that happening in film and TV at a younger age. Car crashes are more understandable to grasp. But I would have been about five. Clearly Nan was talking to one of the other kids' parents at school, because they'd, a few people were just wondering why it was Nan always there and never Mum. And she told them, and then somehow this kid had found out something, because I think I was telling people who were asking inquisitively, as kids do, what happened. And I was telling them, oh, she died in a car crash. But then one kid said, no, that's not true. And I didn't understand it then, and I didn't believe him, of course. But then I asked my Nan when she picked me up, and I was sitting in the back seat, little chauffeur. And she took my hand. And it's interesting because a lot of the saddest moments of my life, I've been in the back seat of that car or sitting in that car, and Nan's been in the car, and she's always took my hand. And she said, no, this is what happened. And in really nice words, I can't remember what, she told me that it was my father's fault and that my mum had been killed. There's always twigs and stuff that falls down from that big gum tree just there. Always falls onto the top. So I always have to make sure she's nice and clean. Not covered in sticks and leaves and stuff, because we don't want that, because she's beautiful. And then this is Mummy. And this is great-grandma, Nana. We got ants today. Lovely.
You don't have any memories of your own, of your mother. How have you formed them? How have you collected them?
I think a lot of what I remember of my mum isn't necessarily a memory. They're not memories. I feel like I've got memories of being with her when I was younger, but they're not memories because she wasn't there. It's like a patchwork of people's memories who have told me stories of how much they loved her, and they've told of some way she's been really cheeky, or some time she's been really loving and caring. And I've kind of put them all together to form my own memories, which is quite interesting. And having seen her stuff and her belongings and treasuring them, you've got like that emotion, and you've got, when you touch something of hers, it's like, I know she's touched that. And so my memories are that they're not real. They're completely a figment of my own imagination, but they feel real. And I think that's what matters to me. Lock in the vase. They smell beautiful. And I think Mum would love them. Yeah, she'd love them. I'm sure she would. So I would have been 18 months old, year and a half, very young Bubba. And from speaking to family and looking through documents that kind of reflect on what happened, apparently my mum and dad were kind of going through a very rough patch, and they were essentially looking at getting separated, and he was accusing her of cheating on him and whatnot. But I know in my heart that couldn't possibly be true. But they were separate. They were living apart at that time, and I was left just with one of my mum's friends. And this was up on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. She went back just to collect some things, I think some clothes and a few bits of furniture and that. And I think she was in the kitchen or something. Or she went to a room and he was in the kitchen, and then she came back, and as she came back in, he hit her across the head with an iron, which had apparently, that was it. Like that killed her. The blunt force trauma was enough to cause enough brain injury that she was dead. But it then went further, and it was quite dark, and I suppose given that he was in a state of just believing that she cheated on him, and it was, he'd broken his heart, that he was in such a fit of rage that he took a knife and he also slit her throat. And I can't even remember if this is 100% accurate from when I've looked at court reports and looked at all that. But apparently he also did something like that too, which is terrible.
I'll admit something to you that you might find really strange, that I find really quite morbid, a morbid behaviour in myself. Even though this is kind of like the first time I've ever spoken to you about it, I kind of knew, I kind of guessed, I joined the dots that something bad had happened. And so this isn't actually the first time, this isn't actually new to me, you telling me all these, the horrible details of how it happened, because I looked online. I'm such a little creepy sticky beak. And I came across this document of a review into cases of
manslaughter.
Yeah, manslaughter. And this case of your parents is used as an example of someone who got an insanely light sentence.
The memory that I have attached, I was in, I think, year two, so I would have been, what, 7 or 8, and given this had happened when I was 1.5, so that's not long, I found out that he'd been released from prison early, and I ended up in hospital. Nothing wrong, but the shock, given I was so young and had known what had happened, I was terrified. I can't even remember the number.
It was 9 years.
I'm glad that you brought that up, that you were doing a bit of sticky beaking and looking that up, because out of all the shitty things that happened, I'm quite proud to say that in at least in the state of Queensland, where they were looking at, where they were using this case study to help review laws into manslaughter, it has made a difference to something far greater. So many other people who deserve longer sentences, and for those families and all those people that have to be on the other end of the horrible situation, they can feel a little bit of a better sense of justice from it. And I feel really glad that something so good can come out of something so horrible.
As we sit here talking, I notice how he's answering all of my awkward questions without hesitation. He's articulate, thoughtful, and calm. There's no anger. But I struggle to hold myself together. I'm furious at the justice system, upset at the senseless loss of life to domestic violence, devastated my friend grew up without a mother. But it doesn't stop me asking one last question.
Have you ever met him? Have you ever met your father?
No, but I did in high school. One of my aunts, she sent out an email, just kind of an email chain with a funny joke, and there in all the CC'd emails was my father's name at hotmail.com or whatever it was, and I clicked it. And for a few days kind of mulled over the decision of, should I send something? And I sent an email, and I think it was just the subject line that said, why? That's all I could put to paper, so to speak. No formalities, no hi, no regards. I didn't deserve any of that in my mind. At that point, this is when I was like 13 or 14, and I was emotional and going through changes, and I was hormonal, and we all are in that time. So I was just angry. And I got a response, and it was quite, there were formalities. It was kind of nice. It was a hi. I wish I could explain what I've done, but I can't, and I can't forgive myself, and I live with that, what I've done every day. Something like that. And I just sat in my inbox for a few days. And then I told I told my counsellor about it, the school counsellor, and I was like, look, this has happened. And they wanted to know, well, did I want to respond? And I wasn't sure. I said, well, that's completely up to you. And I eventually went back to the library and I logged on a computer after school. Tap, 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 tap. And moved it to the trash. And I've not ever thought about contacting him since. It's too hard. And because the plaque doesn't get touched for quite a while, like they don't clean it here, so it's kind of left up to the people that come and visit. So I need to get the shoe polish. Gives it a really good shine. Just got to scrub all the golden letters. Yeah, it gives it a much nicer shine because otherwise it's just dirty and mucky. And this is the picture of Mum. But the same picture at home growing up, which was a professional photo done. And she just looks radiant in her fabulous 80s get-up with the black sequins. But she has my smile. And once she's all clean and once Nana Rose is all clean, give her a good little kiss. And tell her I love her, because I love you. I miss you.
The discussion was produced by Rosa Golan, with sound by Martin Peralta and Stephen Tilley. If you're in an abusive situation or know someone else who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. You can also call Lifeline on 13 11 14. This is Pocket Docs. I'm Natalie Kestacher. And now for a story of corporate culture, Melbourne football, and alienation. A lone figure stands at the edge of a vast scrum, baffled by the invisible rules that dictate the movement of his colleagues through the expansive landscape of Conference Room B. Here's writer Mitchell Welch with the Pick a Side exercise.
They keep asking the same question, over and over, re-springing the same social trap. At first I try to deflect it with humour. Fitzgray, I say. Or Footscray. Collingdon. Essenwood. Richmantle. Freeman, I don't know. But word games alone aren't enough to dissuade the exceedingly earnest, excessively numerous interrogators of Conference Room B. Hi, I'm Andy from corporate, says one fellow, handshake rippling with a disconcerting eagerness of grip. And I'm not at all ashamed to say I'm a long-time supporter of the Melbourne Demons. Melbourne Demons? More like the Melbourne Dreamons, I reply. Reflexively, not sure if it even means anything. It seems like the kind of thing I'm supposed to say at this juncture, and it has the basic rhythm and shape of a joke. Slow motion heartbeat, I'm treading water, staring into Andy from corporate's blank face. But then he cracks a smile, releases me from the handshake, slaps me on the back and moves on. It worked. I know it's only supposed to be a getting to know you, team building type exercise, this process of dividing up the workplace by AFL allegiances. But I'm worried about what it is these new teammates of mine are going to get to know. Way down in the depths of my non-substantial core, I'm different. Adrift. Teamless. Non-tribal. Unaligned. Indifferent to sports on almost every level. Another co-worker approaches. I try the Melbourne Dream On's line again. But already the words have started to lose any semblance of shape and meaning. The Melbourne Demons, more like the Belmont, the Melbourne Dermans, the Merple, I'm getting desperate here. I start pleading unashamedly, listen, please, I'm from Queensland. I've only been in Melbourne a few weeks. Hey, listen, it's okay, they say. There's no shame in barracking for the Brisbane Lions, as long as you don't mind being in a minority of one. All around me, Conference Room B is self-assembling into tribes. The fault lines are charged with kinetic energy. How do I even begin to explain that I don't follow Aussie rules football? But I don't follow any sports at all. I spot a familiar face in the clamorous crowd. It's Annette from Accounts. I grab her by the yellow and black stripes of her woolen scarf. Thank God. Listen, you have to help me. I don't know anything about football. I'm from Queensland, you understand? I don't follow the Lions, or the Tigers, or the Bears. Annette, please, I can't find my team because I don't have a team. Oh, she says, her expression shifting from shock through repugnance to total unmitigated pity. You poor thing. You're from Queensland? Listen, I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but there is a place here for people like you. She motions to a far corner of the crowded conference hall, where a group of thick-necked and downtrodden men drink water from paper cups. Over there, she says, that's the sideline. That's where you poor, wretched rugby fans belong. They don't get it. I don't follow rugby either. I don't follow soccer. I don't follow. I don't belong.
I don't belong. I don't belong. I don't belong.
The world goes long. I'm floating above Conference Room B, looking down on the whole corporate scrum, or ruck, or whatever you call it. Chaos turns slowly to order. People find each other, embrace, and form ranks. Even the most obscure teams have strength in numbers. They make signs and flags with whiteboard markers and butcher's paper and hang them on the carpeted walls. And here I am, floating in space, a man outside the order of things. A lost little boy, stuck outside the MCG without a ticket. And footy season in Melbourne is always brutal cold.
Mitchell Welch from his series Modern Cons. The sound engineer was Russell Stapleton. That's nearly it for Pocket Docs today. Thanks to Jess Binneth and Judy Rapley for studio production. I'm Natalie Kestacher, and I'd like to finish this episode on a positive note with a codpiece by Joe Zareski.
I have changed my religion from believing in no to believing in yes. The idol of no lies broken. I have toppled it over. Inside there was nothing but an echo. Instead, I hear yes at every turn. The evening star says yes. My friend's pussycat says yes. My car says yes on being started. Even your rejection of me is a yes. Ah, would that yes meant yes. This is a one-track mind. Before everything was a no, now it's a yes. I was hungry to hear no, I sought no at every turn. I rejoiced in no and taught no at university. But I have decided that I will not take no for an answer. The only answer I take is yes. My motto is yes. I vote yes. I am a yes man.